Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're heading first to Syria and the funeral of a man whose activism, whose incarceration and torture at the hands of the country's rulers, whose haunted face and tear-streaming eyes became a symbol of the utter degradation and cruelty of the Assad regime. Mazen al-Hamada's body was found on Monday in the morgue of the Sadnaya prison, the prison that the human rights group Amnesty International called a human slaughterhouse. Footage posted online showed mourners today at Mazen's funeral. Chanters at that funeral for Mazen. His story had particular resonance across the world, not just because of the level of violence he endured and the eloquence with which he told his story when he managed to leave Syria, but then the fact that he returned to the country in 2020 despite the immense risk. Before going back, one of the interviews Mazen had given was for the TV documentary Syria's Disappeared. He described an interrogation by security officers.
He said, "What type of weapon did you have?" I told him a camera, impertinently. I told him a Toshiba camera. And I didn't carry weapons. I hate weapons. And he told me, "I don't want these confessions. Take him. You will confess. If you don't confess, we'll kill you." I told him, "That's all I have."
Well, the director of that documentary was the filmmaker and journalist Sara Afshar, and she joins me now. Sara.
Hi, Tim.
Hello. Thank you very much for joining us on NewsHour. And before we get on to what must be a world of emotions for you today, but just give me some sort of impression as to what Mazen was like.
Yeah, Tim, it's a really, really difficult day for all of us who had the privilege to know Mazen and spend time with him. He was an incredibly gentle soul, a kind person. I first met him in 2016. And really what motivated him most, what kind of drove him every second of the day after the experience of torture that he went through in Syria, is that he wanted to save his fellow prisoners. That's all he could think about and all he wanted to do. And he had an incredible urgency to do that. And that's why he did the interview and he did other interviews, and he opened himself up and talked about everything that happened to him in a way that so many people were not prepared to do, understandably, because it was so incredibly traumatic. So he was incredibly generous with himself, with his time.
He was willing to relive the trauma in order to try and make others begin to understand the levels of depravity that were being handed out routinely.
Yes, because he was desperate to tell the world what was happening, and he was desperate for the world to act, and the world didn't act.
And do you think that that was part of the reason why, in the end, he decided to take that, I mean, unimaginable risk of returning to Syria, was that he felt that, in a sense, there was no more to be accomplished?
Yes, absolutely. He became very frustrated. So, I mean, we broadcast the documentary in 2017. We took it to policymakers. He spoke to policymakers. He put every effort, heroic efforts he made to get the story out there and get action on the story. And after 3 years of doing that, you know, which took a real toll on him, he felt incredibly frustrated and he became desperate, and he just thought, fine, nobody over here in the West is going to do anything, so I'm going to go back to Damascus and try to, you know, negotiate with the regime. You know, the regime seems to have lured him back with some, you know, ideas like that. And it might seem fanciful to us or illogical, but you can only understand it, I think, if you'd been through the hell he had been through, and all he could think about were the people still there. bearing in mind over 130,000 disappeared people. And, you know, in the prison that he was in Air Force intelligence, the horrific things that he said happened to other people. He was desperate to get them out, including, you know, there was a member of his family also there, and there was a member of his family disappeared in another prison. And we have no news of them either, you know, since 2011. So I really wish that people would think about it in that context. It may seem like it was such a risky thing to do. And obviously, no, his family tried to stop him from going. We were all shocked that he went, and we were devastated that he went back.
And the fact that his body was discovered in the morgue, I mean, it seems as if the signs are that he was killed in the dying days of the regime as well.
That, we don't know exactly what happened, and we're trying to get to the bottom of that. Obviously, that is a very, very hard thing for us to have to hear and bear. But it is. But, you know, this was a monstrous regime. This is the kind of thing that they would do. And I just hope that, you know, his legacy will be that there will be justice.
Sarah Afshar, we're very grateful to you for joining us on what is obviously an extremely painful day for anybody who knew Mazen al-Hamada. Sarah Afshar, filmmaker and journalist and director of that documentary, Syria's Disappeared. Well, change in Syria is everywhere. You can see it in the expressions on people's faces, a mixture of hope and concern. You can see it in the prison doors that have been wrenched open, in the Assad family statues toppled, the posters torn down. And you can see it in what was the very centre of ostentatious power, Bashar al-Assad's presidential palace in Damascus, one of his many residences, used to project his power, the place to welcome foreign dignitaries and sometimes journalists. Now, it's a broken and beaten shell where former rebels sleep on the marble floors and residents come to take photos. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who has in the past interviewed Assad in that palace, returned to the complex and then sent us this report.
We've just arrived at the presidential palace, the big one on the hill overlooking Damascus. Now, there are fighters from Tahrir al-Sham, the group that overthrew the Assads here on the gate. I want to get in here because this is where I used to, from time to time, meet President Bashar al-Assad. Well, we're driving into the very, very grand and spacious palace grounds, and our Syrian driver is actually filming as we go. And, you know, this is a big deal for him, even getting into this place. There is no way an ordinary Syrian would be allowed up here.
This is my first time here. This palace is for the people, but the people never saw it. It's like a dream. Even now, some people think that he's still here, and they are afraid of him.
I'm walking over some broken glass to get in to the door. You know, it's extraordinary coming into this place. There's a fighter with a beret with an Islamic slogan on, walking out with a cup of tea. It is quite an extraordinary feeling walking into this great echoing marble hall of the palace. There's a red carpet and some kind of burnished copper ceiling. I mean, nothing's really been badly damaged here. It used to be that coming in here, you would have to have permission. It was quite an event. And now there are fighters wandering around, journalists like us. It's an echoing shell of a place, probably suitable for what became an echoing shell of a dictatorship. Some of the property of the Assads is now almost like visitor attractions. We're just at the gateway of a very beautiful, large villa, which I think was the residence of the Bashar al-Assad family. Beautiful gardens. I mean, stunning place with shutters, pine trees outside. Here, Tahrir al-Sham fighters lending young men their guns so they have pictures taken for Instagram. It's a sign of change. couldn't do this before. You wouldn't even be able to stop your car outside before.
My name is Shukri. I'm from Damascus. I'm here to see the presidential palace, to see how the president lived and to contrast his life with our lives. We lost our freedom. We lost many people. No electricity, no fuel, no water. But the president and his people and the people who supported him had a very different life. We're hoping for a better future now.
Away from the main palace, there's a mini palace. Now, the story was that this was designed as a private residence for the Assad family, but they didn't like it, so it was used as a guest house. When I interviewed him, it was where I'm standing now, which is in the walnut-paneled library. Lots of worthy-looking, untouched books. And if I just walk out this way and across the checkerboard marble floor, marble tables, walnut doors, crystal chandeliers. I mean, this is a very opulent place. And I'm just going in there now through the door. There's this anteroom. So it's an anteroom. It's a sitting room as big as a tennis court. And the way it worked was that before the interview, Assad would take you off for private time for a chat. And because he looked a bit gawky, sometimes people in the West thought he's a bit weak, he can be pushed around. But sitting privately with him, I never had that impression. He instead was a man who was self-confident in his conversation, really to the point of arrogance. He felt that he was the kingpin. He thought he was the spider in the middle of the web of the Middle East, and he knew exactly what was going on and the right things to do and the best things to do. And he kept, of course, saying it was for the Syrian people, not for the Assad family. While Bashar al-Assad, when you met him, he was extravagantly polite. When I walked into this room, he'd stand back when the door was open, say, after you. And then if he was sitting down when you came in, he'd leap to his feet, a rather tall, skinny man in an expensive suit. And he'd say, welcome, and, you know, how is the family, and how is your journey? And he never seemed to be the guy, actually, who would be at home in the torture cell, watching people screaming their last. But I always did feel that he wouldn't think twice about giving the order to send the person to the torture cell, or to the jail, or to the gallows. And, of course, Bashar al-Assad, his family, his acolytes, his security people, they did that thousands and thousands of times.
And that was Jeremy Byrne reporting from one of Assad's presidential palaces in Damascus. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up, we'll hear from some children in the English city of Liverpool. They were distraught when their local library was damaged by rioters. They're now delighted to have it reopened.
My name's Riley and I'm 8.
Tell me about how you felt when you found out that the library had been burnt.
Not very happy because it's somewhere that people like to go.
I was very sad because that's a library I always go to and I love reading.
I love reading too. You'll hear that absolutely delightful piece in about 25 minutes. Our main headlines in the BBC newsroom this hour: Joe Biden's commuting the sentences of around 1,500 people in what the White House says is the largest presidential act of clemency in a single day in modern US history. And as we've heard, a funeral is being held in Damascus for the Syrian activist Mazen al-Hamada, whose tortured body was found in the notorious Sednaya prison after the fall of the Assad regime. You're with the BBC, and this is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. The South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, appears to have had a change of mind, or at least a change of tone. 5 days ago, he'd gone on national TV to apologise profusely for declaring martial law last week and saying that he'd leave it to others in his People's Power Party to decide on whether he should even stay in office. Today, Mr. Yoon made a surprise second appearance on TV, and this time, he sounded far more defiant.
For the past 2.5 years, I have only looked to the people, fighting against injustice, corruption, and the tyranny disguised as democracy. I fervently appeal to you all to unite in the path of protecting the Republic of Korea and our liberal democracy, which we have guarded with blood and sweat. I will fight with the people until the very last minute.
The president spoke as opposition lawmakers tried to organise efforts for a second attempt to impeach him. As for how President Yoon's words went down, two voices, two very different opinions from residents of the capital, Seoul.
I thought it was utter nonsense. The president has already taken actions against democracy. I think this is unacceptable and it's close to a dictatorship.
I think the president did a good job with his speech today, and the impeachment shouldn't happen. I heard the martial law troops left the National Assembly only after 2 hours, so the martial law declaration was merely an expression of the authority of the president. The Democratic Party, which is currently holding the country back, is the real issue.
But it does seem as if within the National Assembly, President Yoon's support is slipping ever further away. Minutes before he spoke, the leader of his party, Han Dong-hoon, also appeared on television to say it had become clear the president wasn't going to step aside, and so he urged his fellow party members to back the impeachment bill this Saturday. Last time, almost all the PPP MPs had boycotted the session and so scuppered the vote. The only PPP MP who did stay in the chamber throughout was Ahn Chol-soo. So what did he make of the president's avowal today that he was going to stay in office and fight?
Before today's president's speech, I was expecting the president to address the timeline and methodology of voluntary resignation and the formation of a neutral cabinet I had called for. However, the president said that he has no intention of leaving office, and that he will see it through to the end in the Constitutional Court.
You were disappointed then by what the president had to say?
Yeah, so I was very, really shocked. It occurred to me that he was trying to fight the Korean people. It sounded like a super spree to avoid the responsibility.
I guess he must be drawing support from some quarters, though, and I mean, the obvious place to look is from within the party that you both belong to, the People's Power Party. There are clearly people, your fellow members of the National Assembly from the PPP, who do support him and are telling him to stay and fight. Why do you think that is?
It's complicated. We are ruling party, but a minor party in Korean Assembly. So we cannot pass any law if opposition party allows it. The president is very frustrated about this situation. That's why he thought of martial law. And there is some conflict between presidential office and the ruling party in South Korea. And there is some misunderstanding and some emotional conflict between them. And we are not very well cooperated. It was a very difficult feeling when all my colleagues actually left and I was alone. But however, I voted until the end.
And do you think that more of your colleagues from the PPP will support you if there is another vote to impeach the president on Saturday?
I'm not sure, but some people announce he will support me in front of the press.
But what's your best guess? Do you think that there will now be a two-thirds majority in the National Assembly for impeaching the president?
I'm not sure. But if the impeachment will not approve, the opposition party will suggest the motion again and again.
And that was Ahn Chol-soo, the PPP MP, who does think that the president should step down. Eunwoo Lee is a columnist at The Diplomat, an international current affairs magazine for the Asia-Pacific region. Eunwoo, thanks for joining us. Is it a case of when, not if, the president goes, do you think?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, I was just wondering if you think that actually, despite the president saying that he is going to stay and fight, that his days are very much numbered now.
Yes. So he's not balking under the national pressure to step down. He literally told the nation that he will stick to his duty. He's not going to step down, and he will fight the impeachment process at the Constitutional Court if the National Assembly decides to impeach him.
Yeah, but it, I mean, what are his chances? It sounds as if he hasn't got much of a chance of surviving an impeachment vote.
He doesn't stand a high chance of surviving it at the National Assembly. But the thing is, the National Assembly vote for impeachment has to be authorized and approved by the Constitutional Court. And at the moment, the Constitutional Court has 6 judges. And then we need a unanimous decision to impeach Yoon at the court to finalize the impeachment process. And I think that's... We can't say for sure if all the judges are going to agree.
Understood. But I guess, I mean, one of the questions here is how much damage you think this might be causing the PPP. I mean, it sounds like the party leader is now saying, he really has to go. I mean, presumably, if his own party, if support begins to drain away from his own party, as well as from, you know, the entire opposition, it's going to make his position extremely difficult, isn't it?
I mean, you're right. The longer the PPP and its leadership doesn't act to support Yoon's impeachment, the more the public sentiment is going to sour on the PPP, and then they'll remember this in the next presidential election or general elections. But the PPP's calculation is that they can't afford to hold another presidential election soon. Otherwise, they'll 100% lose the election. So they're just biding their time, so the nation cools down and they can have some moment to distance themselves from the presidency.
Yeah, I mean, we had voices in support and in opposition of Mr. Yoon from that those clips that we played of Seoul residents. I mean, how can you gauge how much support he has in the country?
Our polls suggest that he has around 15% adamantly supporting Yoon, despite his declaration of martial law. And then this is 15% hardcore far right conservatives who will support Yoon no matter what. But besides that, 85% is they are really, really disappointed by him, and then they want to see him gone.
Mm. If you were a terrible thing to ask a journalist, but if you were a betting person, I mean, what do you think? Do you think he can hang on until the impeachment process runs its course, or do you think the chances are, in a sentence, do you think the chances are he's going to have to go?
He will wait it out until the very moment he has to be, like, literally dragged out of his presidential seat.
Okay.
And I believe that he will wait until the Constitutional Court decision, which might be sometime. I mean, if the National Assembly passes the vote, it might be around next March or April or even June.
Unwu, thank you. Welcome back to NewsHour. Football's world governing body, FIFA, has formally confirmed Saudi Arabia as hosts of the 2034 Men's World Cup. The decision came by acclamation rather than a vote. The kingdom emerges the only candidate from FIFA's fast-track process. The selection has been fiercely criticised by human rights groups and environmental campaigners. We can speak now to Kate Mason. She's a sports broadcaster, has also investigated the Qatar World Cup. Kate, no surprise, but in a way it is. It is a bit of a surprise, isn't it, that Saudi is hosting this World Cup when you sort of stand back and look at it?
Yeah, I mean, if you thought that this would be what would be happening back in 2018 when women were still not allowed to drive in the kingdom and hadn't yet been allowed into a football stadium, you might have been surprised to imagine that the biggest show on earth, well, depending if you choose the Olympics or this, was heading to Saudi Arabia. There's sort of three concerns, really, or three major brackets of concerns. The way, as you mentioned, that the process has been seemingly organised so that for 2034, the only viable candidates were from either Oceania or Asia. So that limited effectively who could possibly apply, and the short term quickfire nature of it, meaning that Australia ultimately pulled out of bidding again because they didn't feel as though they had the chance to do it. And then, as you mentioned, that the human rights questions in the country, which is something that the closest possible comparator to is, of course, Qatar, which we've recently seen. and the questions from that World Cup and how the stadiums were built and some of the human rights abuses in the country are still very closely documented and very much live questions, Tim.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, this is something, these tournaments cost vast amounts of money, especially when there are new stadiums to be built, and that's not going to be a problem for Saudi. Is it going to be a problem, though, these concerns? Do you think it's going to be a problem for any of the teams that are due to, I mean, who knows who will qualify, but, you know, whether there will be pressure on some football associations or some players not to go to Saudi?
Well, we had this conversation in the run-up to the Qatar World Cup, and in the end, ultimately, if you were picked, you went. And I think it's a huge challenge, really. And the conversation then was the same, which is that really there are organisations, major kind of bureaucratic organisations around this football enterprise, and really individual players should not be having to take on the role of spokesmen for their country in this kind of context. I mean, there is very few out gay male players in the game. Josh Cavallo is one, and he's already said that LGBT players won't feel safe playing in Saudi Arabia, or he personally wouldn't feel safe. And these kinds of conversations are live. But in terms of what we saw, you know, there was a big conversation around that in Qatar, and the subsequent questions about labour abuses and this figure of 4,000 a death.
We'll have to leave it there. But thank you much. Now, medical staff in Gaza saying Israel's latest airstrikes have killed Palestinians who were trying to guard aid supplies. Security trying to stop armed gangs seizing the humanitarian shipments is, according to UN workers, one of the main obstacles to getting vital relief supplies to people in Gaza. 12 of the workers who were in Rafah, right on the border with Egypt. Another Israeli strike hit members of a team doing a similar security job in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Among them was Nasser Banat, who lost family members in the strike.
At night, there were trucks carrying aid for people because people here are starving. We in our house don't have flour because, as you can see, the country is on the verge of famine. My son and my son-in-law went out at night. People reached out to them. Come, secure some flour or a box of aid to be distributed. They went, my son-in-law, my son, and the young man with them. It seems the occupation forces were waiting for them. They targeted them, and all of them were martyred.
Bushra Khalidi is policy lead on the occupied Palestinian territories for the aid agency Oxfam, and she joins me now from Ramallah on the West Bank. Bushra, clearly there will be concern about these strikes on people who were said to be helping to guard this aid. What do you think? What impact do you think it will have on what's already a difficult business in Gaza?
Indeed. Thanks, Tim, for having me today. I mean, this has an enormous impact. Actually, a couple of days ago, there was a route that was successfully accepted by the Israeli authorities and negotiated with the humanitarian country team to be used and to be kind of piloted. And it worked. There was no looting. In fact, just two or four trucks, I think, broke down. But otherwise, the 105 trucks out of the 109 made it safely to the UN warehouses. And so we thought that this was a really great, like, step forward, considering the lawless situation and then the lack of law and order and the absolute chaos and in Gaza, and within a couple hours, that shipment had an impact, direct impact on the price of flour in Gaza. But instead of it being about $200 a bag, it was reduced to $100 a bag. But still, that's half the price. And so right now any goods entering Gaza have an enormous impact. And so any truck that doesn't go in, and this, I think, in particular, was a lot of flour as well to stabilize the market and stabilize the price of flour, but also to provide for free humanitarian aid for those in need. This is a tragedy. This is, yet again, you know, another massacre, another airstrike on a humanitarian convoy, another airstrikes on humanitarian workers, and another compromise on the entire humanitarian response.
Do you think there is any need? I mean, is there a way of trying to coordinate this better, in the jargon, to deconflict, given that this is happening, you know, in a way that is not...
Very simple, Tim. Simple. It's about opening all the crossings. Israel needs to allow all the crossings to be open simultaneously. That's number one. Number two, there needs to be an absolute, you know, complete free flow of aid coming into Gaza 24/7. It's not about 100 or 200 or 500 trucks. It's trucks completely all the time coming in and out of Gaza with no interference, no checkpoints, no, you know, with the checking that is needed, but not, you know, and no targeting of humanitarian convoys. And finally, it's the obligation of Israel as the occupying power, occupying Gaza, to protect the civilian population. And part of this protection of civilian population in Gaza is to make sure that aid gets to the place that it needs to get. It's not enough to just open the gate and to allow the truck in. It's to make sure that that truck is safe and secured up to the delivery point and make sure that humanitarian aids can deliver that aid impartially, abiding by our humanitarian principles. That's not happening, simply. It's not happening.
Bushra Khalidi from Oxfam, speaking to me from Ramallah in the West Bank. Thank you very much for joining us. We began the programme with one illustration of the barbarity of the Assad regime in its treatment, its detention, torture and killing of political prisoners. Another illustration was in its use of weaponry to terrorise civilians, barrel bombs dropped from helicopters on residential areas and chemical weapons which were used repeatedly. The BBC's Yogita Lamaya went to the Damascus suburbs of Douma to meet survivors of attacks back in 2018. Three members of Khalid Nasir's immediate family members were killed when Syrian forces dropped what was suspected to be chlorine gas cylinders on two apartment buildings.
I lost my wife and my children. All the women and children in our area were killed. Then they took my family from me. They buried them on top of each other. And then the regime came back 2 days later and burned them. They burned them so no one would know they were killed by the chemicals. Assad and all the liars need to be brought to justice.
Tawfiq Diam described being unable to speak out about the attacks because of fear of reprisals.
I have four children, Omar, Ali, Muhammad and Judy. They all died along with their mother. A barrel bomb fell into the middle of the neighbourhood and exploded. They blew up the water tanks. The smell filled the neighbourhood and entered the buildings. It was a yellow-coloured gas. The smell was horrible. But at the time, we didn't dare speak.
Well, now, the leader of the main rebel force has told the Reuters news agency today that HTS's group were working with international organisations to secure possible sites where chemical weapons may be located. Lenny Phillips is Senior Research Fellow on Proliferation and Nuclear Policy at the think tank the Royal United Services Institute in London.
In terms of neutralising them, there are different methods that can be used. I mean, obviously, the most definitive use is to use incineration or thermal oxidation, however you want to call it. But there are neutralisation techniques that can be used as well. If you put the situation where, as we understand it, some of these facilities have been targeted by Israel, we don't know the situation on the ground. We don't know whether chemicals are still in a container, whether the container has been breached, whether there are access issues to actually get to the containers themselves. Now, I think it's fairly clear that there is more than likely going to be the precursors for sarin. Given that sarin was continually used after supposedly it had all been declared, that is fairly toxic. Even the precursor is fairly toxic. So that would need careful handling. They also were using chlorine, you know, quite often. And chlorine in itself, it's an industrial chemical. It has many uses, vast uses outside of dropping them on people. So at what point does chlorine become a chemical weapon and therefore have to be destroyed? That then becomes a very difficult question. Chlorine cylinders with fins on them and maybe explosive wrap around them, of course, much more clearly indicates the likelihood was that it was going to be used as a chemical weapon. Chlorine in itself would present more sort of political and legal issues rather than coming back to sarin is fairly clear.
Can I ask you, you mentioned the Israeli strikes that there have been on some chemical weapons areas. Now, there are plenty of people who say that Israel should not be carrying out this sort of preemptive action at all. It doesn't have the right to do so. Just in terms of trying to degrade the capability, though. Is it something that is that can be achieved in this way and in that sense could be deemed to be useful, even if people question its legality? Or is it something that carries immense risks just because you're talking about potentially unstable compounds?
If you're talking about them destroying, shall we say, an aircraft hangar that has a production facility inside it, that has no chemicals inside it, then yes, you've hit capability without really causing an issue that's related to the chemicals, because maybe there's no chemicals in there. As soon as you introduce chemicals, you're introducing a lot of complication. You're talking then, have you actually destroyed the container in which was actually holding the chemicals security? If you have, where have those chemicals gone? They've probably invaded the space or the environment in which the containers were held. I can understand Israel's position, but blowing up chemicals, it's not a good way of dealing with it for people who've got to come behind later.
And that was Lenny Phillips speaking to me. He's from the Royal United Services Institute. Now, a small slice of light and loveliness to bring you. You may remember the riots in the UK in August, driven largely by far-right agitators. Among the places badly damaged was a public library in Liverpool, northwest England. It's called Spellow Library, and more than $320,000 was raised for repairs to the building to replace the books lost in the fire. Last night, on the eve of the reopening, more than public libraries around the country lit up to share the light, as they put it, with Spellow. And in Liverpool, local schoolchildren celebrated with a lantern parade. Katie Hasseldine was there.
My name's Riley and I'm 8.
Tell me about how you felt when you found out that the library had been burnt.
Not very happy, because it's somewhere that people like to go.
I was very sad, because that's a library I always go to and I love reading.
Why are you so excited? Tell me what you enjoy about the library.
I probably enjoyed the way that it's so calm, because I get annoyed lots easily by the noise, honestly.
What kind of books do you like reading?
Joke books and stuff.
Joke books. Have you got any good jokes for me?
Yeah.
Go on then.
Why did the Queen go straight lines? Because she was the ruler.
Very good. Very good. What's the first thing you're going to do the next time you visit?
Return me books.
They'll be long overdue by now, won't they? And they're off. A huge blue light up there, accompanied by its cub, leads this procession from Goodison Park to Spellow Lane Library. The Steel and Sheep Marching Band are who you can hear, bringing the party atmosphere with their light-up instruments. And hundreds of school children and their parents are joining them, carrying lanterns to bring back the light to Spellow Lane Library, which was torched during those riots in the summer. Are you excited for the library to reopen?
Yeah, I'm getting emotional. When I first burned down, I was crying my eyes out. Aww. That's the only library we go to.
So we're inside the Spellow Library now, just reopened by Pearl. Tell me about how you got the honour to lead this evening's parade.
So my principal, Principal Ropa, she rang my mum and asked her if I could be nominated to take part in this parade. And my mum said, of course. So I got picked and I'm here.
Tell me what it's like in here. What was it like before? Is it quite similar?
Yeah, it was very similar, but because most of the things here are burnt down, they've got a lot of new things.
Yeah. And what are you looking forward to the most then?
I'm looking forward to borrowing that book that I was just reading after the library's opened.
Yeah.
When I was told to stop reading, I'm like, but I want to read more.
One of the young readers of Liverpool delighted that their Spellow Library is back and functioning. Katie Hasseldine reporting. This is NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. When Syria's rebel leader Ahmed al-Sharaa, as he now calls himself, he's dropped his nom de guerre, Abu Muhammad al-Gilani, made that speech in the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus as the capital fell on Sunday, there was one line which maybe didn't get a lot of play, but
which could be very significant. It was this.
نشر فيها الطائفية أثار فيها الفساد أصبحت.
Syria has become the biggest producer of Captagon on earth. And today, Syria is going to be purified by the grace of God.
Syria has become the biggest producer of Captagon on earth, he said. Well, Captagon is an amphetamine-like drug. It's a stimulant and it's big in the Middle East. Last year, the BBC aired a major investigation into Captagon, speaking to people involved in the illicit trade, including this soldier.
My pay is 150,000 lira. This is barely enough for someone supporting two or three children. So we've become dealers, selling to people. It's what brings most of the money now. The army's 4th Division facilitates our movement. If there was a traffic jam, they would clear it. The primary persons responsible for the drugs manufacturing and trade are Bashar al-Assad and his brother, Maher al-Assad. The money goes straight into their pockets.
Caroline Rose is the director of the New Lines Institute. It's a Washington-based global politics think tank. She's been looking into Captagon and its international reach.
It's an amphetamine-type stimulant that is extremely popular in the Middle East. It's a drug that ultimately allows users to stay up at night, to participate in recreational activities such as nightclubs or partying. It also allows users to stave hunger. And then also Captagon can suppress trauma and create feelings of invincibility and euphoria, which is very popular amongst fighters in the region, as a Captagon can be seen as something that enhances their war fighting capabilities.
And in terms of Syria's role in all this, how big an industry did it become under the Assads, and how far was it something that they took an active part in fostering?
In the early 2000s, there was evidence of Captagon in the Levant in the region, but this was largely in labs that were run out of people's basements or in garages or small warehouses. We didn't necessarily see an industrial scale until around 2018, 2019. This was evidenced by extremely large seizures of Captagon consignments, and this indicated a change in production capacity. And very soon, we started to see signs that the Syrian regime was, in fact, behind this sponsorship of production. We saw the 4th Armored Division, which is a key element of the regime's security apparatus, protecting these flows, but also operating several laboratories, some of which, by the way, were just found in the last 2 days in Damascus and Latakia and in Douma. And these large-scale factories really enabled the regime to transform this from an illicit trade into an industry that would allow it to sustain itself and buffer against international sanctions, economic collapse, and a weakened Syrian currency.
And I can imagine that, you know, with the new rebel rulers of Syria sort of saying, we will clamp down on this, that's going to be an attractive message in terms of Syria's neighbours in the region, that they will say that, you know, we're going to ensure that less of this drug gets into your markets. But it's, I presume, it's not necessarily something that can be shut down all in one go.
Certainly. I think that we're seeing the close of one chapter and the opening of another. And the chapter that we were just in, that where we're seeing this conclusion, it's the chapter of Syria serving as a narco state, really where the regime was involved systematically in the sponsorship of production and trafficking of Captagon. And now what we're seeing is that likely many non-state actors are going to seek to diversify how they conduct and operate this trade.
Caroline Rose from the New Lines Institute. Chess has a new world champion, and he's the youngest ever, the 18-year-old Indian, Domaraju Gukesh. He beat the defending champion, the Chinese player Ding Li Ren. Levi Rosman is an American chess master and the host of Gotham Chess YouTube channel, and joins us now. Levi, big moment.
Huge. And thank you for having me. Yeah, the youngest world champion in history, beating, you know, the record of Garry Kasparov, which for some of the listeners would certainly resonate.
Yeah, he was all of 22, an old man. Now, just give me a sense. I mean, first of all, it was an extraordinary end to what had been a very, very tight contest, hadn't it? Because they were tied. And then Ding Li Ren made this
astonishing, so I read, astonishing endgame pawn blunder.
Yes. So to give some context to the audience quickly, you know, it's not a knockout. They don't play just one game. They play 14, a best of 14. So you need to win 7.5 points. A half point is for a tied game, and you get 1 point for winning. And it was 6.5, 6.5. And this was the final game. And it was 3-4 hours into the final game. And it was a draw. It was going to be a tie. They were going to go to tie breaks tomorrow. And Ding basically traded off all of his pieces into a completely losing position. And baffling, astonishing is a... Those words are understatements.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's because Gukesh just sort of... the pressure was relentless from him.
It was the pressure. It was the fact that the entire match had been a bit strange. Like, Ding was very happy ending games early, if that makes sense. Imagine a football match was tied 0-0 and they just left at halftime and they never played the second half. He was just sort of happy to do that, kind of conserving his energy, seemingly going for the tiebreaks. And today it just came back to bite.
Right. And then, I mean, I was watching, I'm afraid I'm too stupid to understand the intricacies, but much as I play chess at a astonishingly low level, but you didn't have to have any expertise to see the emotion at the end. I mean, it was just Domaraju. He looked like a young man who was just overcome with emotion.
Yeah, we've almost never seen that. We see chess players hold their heads in their hands. We see athletes cry and everything. Gukesh couldn't contain his smile. He couldn't believe what was unfolding on the board. And you could see him sit back down and try to bite his lip, literally to prevent himself from smiling. But then, you know, you see the celebration and the adoration and the hug with the father after. It's really special. And he knows he's coming home to, you know, over a billion people that are cheering for him.
Yeah. And I mean, it is increasingly, it seems, a young man's game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've lost to 11 and 10 year olds that are already better than me. And I'm nearly 30, which, as you said, is a dinosaur for this game.
Levy, you're far too modest, but it's lovely to have you on. Thank you very much. And paying tribute there to Domaraju Gukesh, the new world champion, the youngest ever world champion in chess, 18 year old from India. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for your company.